This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with James Button. How are you, James?
I'm very well, thank you. We're here at the Decanter World Wine Awards. A nice sunny day, so
yeah,
couldn't be better.
Yeah, and it is quite warm out there today. You're one of the regional editors for Decanter. I think you specialise in...
Yeah, so I'm the Italy editor for Decanter, focusing all my attention on Italy.
That must be exciting.
It's a big job. I'm very happy to be doing it.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a very diverse country.
You don't sound Italian. Do you speak Italian?
A very little bit, yeah. Learning all the time.
Yeah.
Learning all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You got your hands still. I always think when you talk Italian, you got to wave your arms around.
Yeah, yeah. Learning the gestures is a big part of it, for sure.
Yeah, my family is from Italy, and I've picked up that, what do they call it, gesticulation
sort
of thing as part of that as well. Brilliant. Okay. What we're going to talk about today is a bit about the Decanter magazine and the Decanter website as well, and just get a feel for it. We did a podcast with Decanter 2006,
wow, okay.
18 years ago. So I thought it was a nice chance just to find out what's happened in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, quite a lot's changed since then. I mean, interestingly, Decanter was one of the first publications to have a website, which I believe was founded in the year 2000. So on that side of things, we've always been quite ahead of the curve. I joined in 2016, which still feels quite a long time ago, actually. We've gone through a few changes editorially, and so the current structure that we have now, with different regional editors being responsible for particular regions or countries, that came about in early 2020. So that was when I became the Italy editor, for example. And the idea was that previously the editorial team had all been kind of sharing the workload, going to different tasting events and dealing with the PRs and things like that. It all got very confusing. So we were, you know, everyone was getting the same communications from PRs, from producers, and we wanted to simplify it for our readership, for the industry. So by having one point of contact for each region, it just makes it so much simpler. We can specialise more, and it's just a much slicker machine than it used to be.
Okay, so you're regionally... What does that mean? Do you spend all your time flying in and out of Italy and being wined and dined by Italian producers trying to get good press?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes. On average, I'm over there maybe 10 times a year. It tends to be fairly front-loaded, so it depends on the seasons. You know, like the springtime is when a lot of the new wines are launched, so that's when I see myself over there the most. But yeah, you know, it's really nice to be able to go over there at different times of year, because when people think of vineyards, for example, they think of these beautiful, leafy areas with lots of big, fat bunches on them. But you go there in the autumn, you go there in the spring, it's completely different, and it's interesting to see the work that's involved.
Yeah,
it's great.
Decanter itself, the magazine, who is your typical customer?
So you could probably argue that last time you spoke with us for a podcast, our typical customer was the older gentleman. But I think these days our audience is a lot more diverse. There tends to be, and this isn't specifically Decanter, but there is generally a younger audience being interested in wine. So I think it's a lot more diverse. You still have the kind of high net worth individuals. You have the older people with a bit more time on their hands. But you have people that are either, as a side project, they want to learn more about wine. So maybe they're studying for the WSET. You have professionals. And you have people that just like to learn about wine. They like drinking wine, so they want to find out a bit more. We've kind of made a conscious decision over the last few years to give a few more pages towards more lifestyle. So we do a lot of travel coverage. We do some food coverage. We do a thing called Dream Destinations, which is kind of covering, you know, a specific hotel or, you know, somewhere in a beautiful wine area that you can stay. And I think that appeals more to a younger audience that's not so caught up in the high-end, really expensive wines. You know, no one can afford Screaming Eagle these days.
No.
But there are so many good wines out there. at lower price points.
So yeah, I've always thought of Decanter being more focused on the high-end wines rather than the sort of everyday, you know, and very French and Italian, you know, to the classics, as opposed to maybe exploring new regions. Is that a fair...
I think so. I mean, we've always prided ourselves on discovering new things. For example, Decanter was the first place where the word Super Tuscan was coined. I believe it was Nicolas Belfrage who coined that term. And we also, it was a panel tasting that we did back in the 80s, and I think it was the first or possibly the second vintage of Sassicaia, and it beat some very top-end Bordeaux's. And so that kind of made Sassicaia's reputation, and they will happily recount that fact. So, you know, but these days it's more about discovering new things, because if you think about the fine wine market back in 2010, maybe 2011, when the crash happened, the fine wine market crashed. And at the time, the Bordeaux was accounting for, I can't remember the exact figure, but it was something like 85 to 95% of the fine wine market.
Yeah.
That's diversified so much now, and I think that's reflected in our coverage as well.
Yeah, so I the way I saw the evolution of the fine wine market was it was very Bordeaux-centric, and then moved to Burgundy, and then it rolled out into Italy.
Absolutely, yeah.
And where's it going now? You know, you still got your Penfold Granges and your odd wine here and there around the world, but is there a, like, you know, you saw that movement, Bordeaux, Burgundy, Italy, and then... where next?
That's a good question. I mean, so the Bordeaux négociants and the whole La Place system of distribution, that's started to take on more non-French wines over the last few years.
Yeah.
Particularly Italian. There have been quite a few notable Italian wineries joining. So I think they will look to expand outside of Italy, outside of France. Maybe other regions of France might have a bigger say in things. I mean, Champagne goes from strength to strength, really. It seems to be like, they say, in a bad market, buy gold, but I think also Champagne.
What about the American market? Because it's quite a high-value market. You know, there's a lot of cult wines and super premium wines that maybe not have the big volumes of the Bordeaux guys, but they still have the big prices.
Yeah.
And there's, the Americans like their own wines. You know, they spend money. There's money there. It's a big market for Decanter. I think one of your colleagues was saying that Decanter is, you know, the two big markets for Decanter are Britain and US.
Yeah, I mean, certainly online. I would say the magazine distribution is predominantly UK, but also scattering around the world. Whereas online, so we have decanter.com and we also have our Decanter Premium subscription. Both of those, the readership is predominantly North America. And it's a great opportunity for us to reach new audiences. And we now also have an American editorial team based over in the US, headed up by Clive Pursehouse, who's actually here in London this week. So it's great to be able to spend a lot more energy looking into these wines, whereas before we had to focus what we had on maybe here's Napa, you know, but now we can go way outside that boundary. We can do, you know, Sonoma, Oregon, stuff that I don't even know about, all these weird and wonderful things that people want to find out about. And it is going outside of the icon wines of Napa, which are like Bordeaux, they're getting quite expensive. So it's being able to find new upcoming wines, but also new icons.
Yeah, but you've got to always make sure that those wines are attractive to your readership.
Absolutely, yeah. We do have a small investment section, but we don't, in our general editorial, we don't plug wines particularly as, like, you should go out and buy this purely for investment. You know, we are a consumer magazine. These are wines to be drunk.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, because I always think of that you know, your classic investor is likely to read Decanter. Are you saying that it's not really tailored to them, it's more tailored to the high-end drinker?
95% of the time. We do have the occasional investment piece. We have a regular investment section which covers more kind of market trends and things like that. And we do have the occasional piece that focuses on wines for investment, but we try and keep it minimal because, you know, ultimately... wine is our passion. Wine is for drinking and enjoying and speaking with people about. So yeah, there is a balance to be had. But yeah, we are primarily a consumer magazine.
Yeah.
Rather than an investor magazine.
Okay, let's just talk a wee bit about, because you're the man from Italy, tell us the trends in Italy and the sort of things that you've been covering in Decanter regarding Italy.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many. that's why I love it. I mean, if you think there are around, no, I'm not sure anyone actually knows the correct figure, but the off-quoted number is 1,000 indigenous grape varieties. And in fact, I was judging at the Decanter World Wine Awards yesterday, and we had a flight of Tuscan Reds, and the first wine in the flight was a grape variety, 100% of this grape variety, and no, none of my panel knew what it was.
And they're specialists in that area.
I had a master of wine. I had my...
Michelle? Was it Michelle?
Michelle,
interviewed her.
Yeah. I had Michaela Morris, who's one of my key contributors for Tuscany. And then I had someone that works in the UK in marketing for a wine company, and myself. First time for all of us that we come across this grape. And that's what I love. So there are these cool varieties, and I think we will start to see slight tweaks to blends. So, for example, Bulgari, right? So with climate change, you're seeing a bit more Cabernet Franc being used, Merlot kind of going down. Cabernet Franc in a blend in Bulgari.
Yeah, yeah.
The plantings of Cabernet Franc, they're going up.
Really? Because I always think of Cabernet Franc as being a cooler climate wine than a warmer climate wine. So you'd be thinking, well, Bulgari, it's probably getting a little bit warmer. So why are they going to a cooler climate wine?
Because Merlot ripens. It gets a bit too overripe, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a trend that's maybe brought on by climate change, but there are other... The biggest consumer kind of taste trend, I would say, and it goes hand in hand with improved technology, I think, is the increased elegance of wines that you find these days.
Freshness
is working the tannins, I think. Yeah. The ability to just be much more refined in the way they work the tannins in terms of pump overs, punch downs, maceration times, all these things kind of come together just to create really beautifully elegant wines, particularly in places like... Chianti Classico comes to mind at the moment, and also Valpolicella Superiore. Just beautiful light red wine, Schiava as well, to some extent.
What's Schiava?
So it's another indigenous grape variety, also known as Vinache, up in Alto Adige. Synonyms.
Synonyms, okay, yeah, okay, cool.
Worth checking out, though, beautiful.
Okay. Tell me, one of the things that we're seeing is changes in grape variety. You know, you saw Bordeaux introduced Touriga Nacional for their AOC Bordeaux wines a wee while ago, and people are playing around with various grape varieties. Have you guys ever covered Peewee wines at all in Decanter?
Yeah, off the top of my head, I'm not sure if we've done a specific article, but we've certainly discussed them within articles.
Yeah.
And it is interesting, and in fact, I think Italy is one of the leaders at the moment in Peewee varietals up in the Schiava land, basically up in Alto Adige, the north end of Italy. And I think they will play an important role in the future, certainly.
Because I've noticed that there's almost like a subterranean cult of Peewee wines, but the main media aren't really covering it too much.
It's pretty niche, to be fair. In terms of the overall volumes, it's a drop in the ocean, isn't it?
Yep.
You know, I think they have a role to play in that they're less prone to disease, which means you can farm more organically.
Yeah.
And you can just treat your land better.
Yep.
So in theory, you can make better wines.
Yeah, or at least lower environmental impact.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a role to play, and I think we'll see there may be a few years of experimentation to get the recipe right, but I think...
A lot of people know about them, but no one's really talking about them. That's all. And I've tasted a few, and some of them are adapted for cool climate,
yeah,
to be fair. And they're tasting pretty good. And I understand there's a new wave of disease-resistant peewees that have got multiple layers of disease resistance coming through now. So that will make a huge difference, especially organic guys and their bloody copper sulfate.
Yeah. I mean, that's another... It's another trend, isn't it? The kind of move towards organics or biodynamics. And even the people that are already organic or biodynamic, they're trying to reduce, or a few that I've spoken to, they're trying to reduce their use of copper and things like this. I mean, it's about minimal impact, right? Mm.
Yeah, it's tough.
I think we have a responsibility these days. And it's nice to see more and more winemakers kind of taking the next step in sustainability.
Yeah. Do you guys cover anything on like regenerative viticulture or any of those sort of things?
I'm sure we have. Again, off the top of my head, I can't think of a specific example. Yeah, we must have done at some point, I'd imagine.
I'm giving you a hard thing because these are just things on my brain at the moment.
I can give you an example of, so Sicily, I wrote a report last autumn on Sicilian wines, and it's the, not only is it Italy's largest region, but it also has the largest proportion of organic vineyard.
Oh, really? In Sicily? Oh, yeah, I suppose it's
really
dry,
really
isn't it? And you get high up in it.
No, yeah, you have the sea breezes, you have the heat, which, so they suffered last year. So last year was incredibly, I mean, hot. Italy was one of the biggest hit regions, I think, for Peronospora and things like that. But generally, yeah, they're able to farm organically fairly easily.
Yeah.
I think Sicily, if I was going to highlight one region to look at right now in Italy, Sicily is really exciting.
Oh, really? Because I always think of Sicily as being sort of like big bulk wine production.
Well, yeah, it was, wasn't it? It's changed a lot. You know, you have exciting territories like Etna. You have Mount Etna, where there are already some established world-class producers, but there's also people are flocking to it in their droves. And, you know, the quality is slowly improving across the board, I would say.
Okay.
It's got so much potential. And in fact, they've now applied for it to be a DOCG. So Etna has always been a DOC. But I think in the next, how long does it take the Italians to get it done? I don't know. But it should become a DOCG in the next year or two, I would imagine.
Okay. And while we're on Italy, since you know all about Italy, you've mentioned Sicily has been an exciting region. What other regions do you think are sort of like showing something that's maybe a little bit different? You know, like people have, you know, we saw a change in Barolo when they started using oak introductions and things like that, or newer oak in there. What other things are changing in the big classics or maybe new regions that are quite exciting?
Well, the big news at the moment is that in Barolo, there's a bit of a dispute going on between the Barolo, or should I say the wine growers and the truffle hunters, because traditionally the truffle hunters have always used the north slopes that have been unusable for growing grape. So that's been truffle domain. But now, because of the climate and probably because of the increased demand for Barolo and Barbaresco, they're looking to plant on the north slopes, which doesn't leave the truffle hunters with, it puts them at a disadvantage, shall we say.
Yeah.
So that will be interesting to see if that happens.
Which is more expensive, Barolo or truffles?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, isn't
Who
it?
Makes the most money out of it, you know?
I'm not a truffle expert, so I can answer that too accurately. I mean, the most sought-after Barolos are quite expensive, so
yeah,
could be close.
Yeah. And I suppose that's part of the adaption to climate change as well, by using northern slopes. They're a lot cooler, so it gives you freshness if you use it and you blend.
Yep, and, you know, across the board, you see more and more producers using, traditionally, in the northern hemisphere, you want south-facing vineyard, right?
Yeah. But
now you see producers incorporating some southeast, southwest, even west-facing vineyards, just to bring balance to the, because the south-facing vineyards, they ripen so much quicker. They can have high potential alcohol, you know, so it's about finding that balance. And they do that by finding these other sites which are facing, have different aspects.
Yeah.
And I remember a few years ago, Brunello increased the maximum altitude that you could grow vines at.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because everything's warming up, so you go higher, it gets cooler.
Brunello, they had a heated debate about the introduction of non-Sangiovese, or Brunello, whatever you want to call it, into their blends. I know there was quite a controversy about 10 years ago or longer about non-Sangiovese in the blends.
Brunello Gate.
What happened in the end? Did they decide not to include non-Sangiovese in there, or did they?
From my recollection, the overall consensus was that, you know, it should always be 100% Sangiovese.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think now. I don't think many producers wanted international varieties or any other varieties in there.
Yeah. So you're not going to see any super Montalcinos?
Who knows, but let's hope not.
Okay. Before we finish up, you mentioned you've got the magazine and you've got the website, and the website's got a subscription area within that as well. I presume if I'm a magazine, I get access to the subscription website, is it?
There's a bundle.
as a bundle.
So you can, there are options. You can either subscribe to the magazine, as people have done for many years, or you can subscribe to just Decanter Premium on our website, or you can get a bundle for both, effectively.
Okay, and is there much crossover between the Decanter Premium on the website and the Decanter magazine?
Yeah, so Decanter Premium, on there you will find everything that goes into the magazine, but there's also so much more. Most of the work that I commission these days is destined for Decanter Premium. So that includes things like our vintage reports for Barolo, Chianti Classico, Brunello. Also, we do a lot of vertical tastings, so, you know, whatever it may be, Ornellaia or, I don't know, Sassicaia or something like that. So a lot of the lifestyle-y stuff, the learn content, that tends to be available just on decanter.com, so you don't need to subscribe to access that content.
Yeah, I look at the news regularly on there every week.
Exactly.
And that's free.
That will always be free, yep.
Yeah. Excellent. All right then, James, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Lovely. Thank you very much.